So in the next slide is the checklist of what is required on the NTA.
Handy.
And, you know, if you haven't read INA 239A, go back and read it, and then read it again, and then read it a third time, because all of these things matter. Then there's the regulations as well that you want to look at, sort of what I was talking about, who can sign the NTA. That's not in the statute. It's in the regulations. So remember that there is some great case law out there, and I know it was a beginner's class, but remember there's some great case law out there that certain regulations that are drafted and promulgated for the benefit of the non-citizen, they have to be, the courts have said, but and the BIA, they have to be scrupulously enforced if your client is prejudiced, if your client is going to suffer some sort of prejudice. So for example, If the right person didn't sign the NTA, then that's not a legally effective document.
And it is important to remember that these are for the benefit of the non-citizen, the accused. There's a prohibition against the person who did the questioning.
That's right.
From signing, being the person who signs the charging document. So they have to be two different people. So in some cases, you may even need to refer to that I-213, see who questioned your client. It does protect, these are there for the protection of your client, and therefore that's why the government should be following these. For the longest time, challenges to NTAs were kind of like waved off by a judge, like no one's going to support that. Well, you know what? And then years later, now we have Berrieta and Nis Chavez. Like, no, this is actually, you are required to follow your own regulations and statutes.
And you really, again, going back to what I said earlier, it's like you have to see the case all the way to the end. And so you need to make these challenges right now. So, you know, everybody knows what Berrieta is, you know, the case that says an NTA that doesn't have the date and time did not trigger the stop time rule and was a legally defective NTA, and then this Chavez came along. And so if you didn't make that that objection initially, you know, for people whose 42B cases are over and you're trying to reopen, I think it's kind of hard. What happens is that courts are reading some of these objections to the NTA as what are called issues that are claim processing issues. They should have been raised initially. So if you didn't raise them, you lose them, or they are lost. And so just be careful what you concede and what you admit to when faced with the NTA. Proper service is very important. There used to be great law prior to 1996 in terms of service by mail if it couldn't be done personally. By now, regular mail suffices. Most of the NTAs that I've seen are personal service. The client signs for them. But if it's a minor, there's a regulation that if it's a minor, someone else has to be there to sign for the NTA. For regular service of the NTA, there's a presumption that if the client provided that address to ICE, then and it was mailed there, and ICE provided the address to EOIR, and the NTA was mailed to that address, that it's proper. But remember that if that address was provided at a USC and an application filed to the USCIS, that may not be an effective address for purposes of service of the NTA. And I've had many cases reopened.
And there is a lot of times where the address that is provided to the court is the detention facility. I can't tell you how many people have the address on Sunflower Lane in Alvarado, Texas. It's very common. So you want to make sure you take a close look at the notices to appear, because those might be cases where you can go back in and reopen those cases.
Once you get past the service of the NTA, you know, you want to study sort of what Jackie was mentioning earlier, sort of what box is checked off. How is your client being charged? You know, what are the charges under 212 or 237? Why? Because if you haven't read INA 240C4, I think it has to do with the burdens of proof, right? Then if you read that, then you sort of appreciate the fact that if your client is in 237 proceedings, you know, the person has rights. If the person is under INA 212, the person is somewhat screwed, but he's going to be okay. And you want to appreciate sort of what is the burden there. Because in 237, remember, the government is trying to kick someone out. So it's their burden to convince the judge that that the government is right, that your client should be removed. In 212, it is your client's responsibility and burden to show that they are lawfully in the U.S. or that they may have a lawful right to remain in the U.S. either because of relief or some other reason. Read the factual allegations. A young man asked me, you know, should what do you do with the allegations? You deny them. You know, you deny them precisely because of the burden of proof, and because there's really there's very few instances where conceding the allegations is to your benefit, to your client's benefit. Usually, is if you want to get quickly to the individual hearing, or because the government charged your client improperly, and under the improper charge, your client is eligible for relief, whereas if they were charged properly, they would not be eligible for relief.